You're listening to In the Studio with Michael Card. This session is made possible by our friends with the Christian Standard Bible. Learn about this new translation and the many ways you can enjoy the CSB. Explore online when you visit csbible.com. We've titled our conversation, Traveling Mercies. I'm Wayne Shepherd with Michael Card. This is In the Studio. And Michael, you know I love biographies. And you brought home a biography from your recent trip to England that has captured my attention. And we wanted to pass it on to our listeners. So tell us who we're going to talk to in a few minutes.
Well, we're going to talk to the husband of a woman, Louise Russell, who I've been doing concerts with for 30 some odd years in England. She is this remarkable woman, wonderful encourager and great servant. Well, her husband, Adrian, has written a book about a missionary kind of from that period of William Carey. He's brought her back to life. He found her letters online, and there are wonderful pictures in the book. And so she's an amazing person, but Adrian is an amazing person. So it's really cool to get to introduce our listeners to this sweet, sweet brother.
Well, we'll place a call to England and talk with Adrian Russell here today. And by the way, the person he writes about happens to be named Carey, but I understand no relation to William Carey whatsoever.
Although
she was also in India. Well, we'll get into all that coming up here in just a few minutes. Thank you for the use of the CSB Bible translation. You're the one that introduced this to me some time ago, and I've really enjoyed using my CSB Bible.
Yeah, it's really my main Bible now too. And the thing I love about the CSB is, if you're like me, Wayne, we think in NIV. I mean, when we were little, we read King James.
Well, I'm older. I think in King James. Yeah.
Really? Okay. Or the Latin Vulgate. Are you still working in the Latin Vulgate?
Careful now.
But I mean, when I was little, I read the King James too. But then, you know, in high school and college, you know, basically NIV was coming out. And it's great to be saturated sort of with a translation like that, especially a good one like the NIV. But the problem with that is you always sort of know, especially in the Gospels with me, I always know what the next verse is going to say. And you should never think you know what the Bible is about to say. And so one of the great things about the CSB is it's fresh. And I know the translators. I was actually one of the people on the team. So I saw the process. I saw these wonderful scholars agonizing over every little detail. And I really do. I love the CSB.
Well, in a men's Bible study this very morning, I was reading from the CSB, and the men stopped and said, "What version do you have?"
So,
it's kind of fun to bring something new to the table, huh?
It's based on newer manuscripts and newer scholarship, and I really do think it's a great new translation.
Well, just before we hear a song from you, Michael, and then hear from our guest today, I want to share this note from Joel. "I just wanted to share with you that my parents would listen to your Present Reality cassette in the car on long road trips, and all us kids would sing along." Talk about age. There you go, Michael.
Yeah, a lot of people tell me you're my mother's favorite musician. I get that a lot now.
Joel says, "I still love that album to this day and listen to it often. I'm so thankful for the talent you were given and your willingness to let it shine for His glory. May God continue to bless you, Michael Card."
Thank you, Joel. I appreciate that.
Well, as Michael has often said, we're all affirmation junkies around here, so thanks for the feedback.
Absolutely. I'll get up and with my walker and go across the room and get some paper and write him a thank you note.
Longhand, of course. All right.
Cursive.
And you can reach us through Michael's website, michaelcard.com, or Facebook, of course, Michael Card Music. We just love to hear from our listeners. Okay, let's hear your song to follow you, and then we'll meet our guest. An exciting story. Thank you.
grow weary when the road's getting long. At each point of my weakness, you make me strong. And when doubt takes over, I remember it's true. I left everything to follow you. To stay safe or to follow, you ask me to choose. But how could I fail when I've got nothing left to lose? Without your call, I couldn't make it. It'd be impossible to do. To leave everything and follow you. Everything to follow. Everything to follow. Everything to follow you. Sacrifice. I gave up my home, but you left paradise. And what you call me to offer has really set me free. 'Cause you left everything to be with me. So with joy I embrace a faith that calls me from home. And I will cling to your promise that I am never alone. And with each passing moment, I'll keep hoping it's true. I left everything to follow you. Everything to follow. Everything to follow. Everything to follow you. Everything to follow. Everything to follow. Everything to follow you.
Michael, we're going to talk with one of your friends from England.
Adrian's one of my favorite people to hang out with in England. So it's great to get to talk to him.
Well, that says a lot right there. Adrian Russell, welcome to our program here with Michael.
Good to speak with you and be invited.
So, Michael, how would you like to start? We need to tell a story here, don't we?
Well,
Yeah,
I don't know where to start other than the fact that the last trip, I showed up at their house and Adrian hands me this book, Marvelously Helped, and I did not know that he was a book writer. I knew that he was a historian and someone who was a fan of history. And lo and behold, here's this wonderful book on a person who might have been lost to history. I think one of the great things about this book, and one of the great things Adrian did, was he has rescued this incredible woman from being lost to history. It's kind of what Kevin Belmonte does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kevin has been with us with telling the story of people like William Wilberforce and others. So, well, tell us about the book, Adrian. Marvelously Helped is the book, and we'll put the information about it in our program notes so our listeners can get a copy. Subtitled, The Trials and Triumphs of Blanche Brenton Carey. Who was Blanche Carey?
And how did you come up upon her?
Well, I can tell you that, and that's all to do with COVID. That is, in the UK, we had a period of lockdown, and we could only go out of the house for a few minutes, kind of exercising. And we decided to go to the local graveyard, which seems a bit bizarre, but it's I kind of like reading gravestones and looking for sort of scripture verses, really. And there mm-hmm. was a revival in England of religion in about the 1850s. And on a number of gravestones around that area about that time, you will find quite a number of scripture verses in England. And there were some great ones in this graveyard. And I wanted to know who influenced these people's lives so that they would, you know, write something so personal to them and such a witness to the people that would go to that graveyard. And I came across a person called Adolphus Carey, who was there in around 1847-48. And so I was interested to know more about him. And I discovered that he had a great family. He had one son that became the first admiral of the Mexican Navy.
Wow.
And he became a brethren missionary to southwest Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to travel on a donkey handing out Bibles to different people there.
Wow.
And then I found this daughter that they had, whose name was Blanche. And her name, full name is Blanche Louisa Mary Boleyn Brenton Carey. The family traced their history back to Mary Boleyn, who was the sister of Anne Boleyn, one of the wives of Henry VIII.
Wow.
So there's quite a bit of a history in their family. But Blanche, I found, was a missionary in Karachi. But that's all I could find out about her until I went to contact a research library in Birmingham in the Midlands in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the pandemic. I can't go there. I can't read any details. But they gave me full access to an archive of the Church Missionary Society. And mm-hmm. I just managed to find a application form to the mission field, which was in 1884. And so I found all her referee letters. And then I found that she was a prolific writer in the magazine of the church society that she belonged to, which was the Church of England Ziana Missionary Society. Ziana means mm-hmm. The place that pertaining to women, because there was an area in the house in India where the women would stay. They wouldn't be allowed to go into the outside world. And men missionaries couldn't speak to these women. So they decided to set up this missionary society called Ziana Missionary Society so that women could go and speak to these ladies. And Blanche became a missionary out to Karachi. And she was there for 65 years.
And wow.
And she kind of seen really amazing events in the history of the world, really, because she was there at the reign of Queen Victoria, but then she kind of, they have their own plague pandemic in the kind of subcontinent area of Asia, and then they have the First World War, they have the Great Depression, they have the sort of decline of spirituality in Britain. And then she has the political upheaval that was taking place in India, mm-hmm. Second mm-hmm. World War, and then partition. So she had these, cataclysmic events that are taking place. And all through that, she's just doing an amazing work with the particularly the women and the girls of this place called Karachi in what that was then India and is now Pakistan. And she had four particular loves, if I can talk about those. Is that all right?
Yeah, that'd be great to hear, sure.
Yeah, she loved Jesus, she loved the Word of God, she loved praying, and she loved people.
Wow.
And she when she first went there, she had a school there, which had about 15 pupils on the roll. And that grew enormously while she was there, so that eventually there was at least 9 schools. At the height, they had 900 students. And there was an orphanage. There was a teacher training college. There was what they called a widow's industrial college, where widows who were particularly badly treated out there. I mean, they had like child marriages, so they would get married at the age of like 10 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
And you heard stories that, you know, you could be a widow, a child could be a widow at 9.
Oh.
And they would go to live with their in-laws. And the in-laws would look at them as they'd sort of brought a curse on the family because their son had died. And they wouldn't look after this person. And you know, you could be age 9 and you're wondering, what on earth's happening? Why doesn't anybody love me anymore? Sort of thing. And so they set up a widow's industrial unit that was able to help women learn a trade and be able to earn a living. And basically to be able to survive. And they just did amazing things. And like a brother, she travelled to the villages near Karachi on camel. So she's never ridden a camel before. So instead of, I don't know if you know Lawrence of Arabia, but we have Brenton Carey of the province of Sindh going to all the villages to tell the men and women about the Lord Jesus Christ. And she's just an amazing, amazing lady. And she had to overcome all sorts of different trials and tribulations. Like her accommodation collapsed. And she was looking after like 40 staff. And at a time when women really didn't look after that number of people or manage such a big organization. And she's desperately trying to get a kind of parent committee, mission board, if you like, back at home, asking for, you know, can they build, can they get money? And they're wanting to put it off as long as possible. And Blanche comes over to the UK and she goes, tours the country. She raises all the funds. So she gets all the funds to be able to build the accommodation again. And the parent committee is still not saying build. And they're living in a temporary sort of area for like 7 years. But she persevered and they managed to build. Just an amazing sort of endurance and perseverance.
I assume she's a single woman?
Yes, they had to be single women to join the mission organization. If they got married, then they had to leave. So yes, you're right. She was single, and again, it's an untold story, really, of hundreds of women going to the unevangelized world to tell people about Jesus. And that must have been very difficult in those days. You know, you're a single woman going to dangerous places. You know, where you're in danger from the climate. There's a lot of missionaries died because the climate wasn't good for them. Some of them who went to China were martyred, and it was just amazing what these women were able to do, really.
Well, Adrian, one of my favorite parts of the book are all the letters that you have transcribed. Now, were you actually looking at the originals when you were doing your research? That must have been incredible.
So. I mean, they were all online. They'd all been archived and put online. They did have a search engine, but it wasn't easy to find because some of them were handwritten as well. So I had to kind of plow through those to find those. But it is great to read what Blanche was saying and writing. And
it's like you're hearing her voice.
Absolutely, yes, you're hearing her voice. So it's like firsthand, isn't it, you know, and you get a sense of she had a great sense of humor as well, which kind of really helped her through those different trials.
Oh, that's marvelous to hear. That's fun to hear in itself. We've talked about some of her trials. Of course, her triumph was the fact that she was serving Christ. I mean, talk about her triumphs, though.
Yeah, well, I mean, just the sheer expansion, really, of the work that was going on in Karachi. I mean, she was also honoured there. She was on the sort of birthday honours list from the royalty, and she got a Kaiser High Eind medal for her services to women. and children in Karachi. And they saw some quite... I mean, when she went there, there was a lot of prejudice against teaching girls. You know, the parents wanted the girls to be married off at a young age or to be sent out to work. And so a lot of girls didn't have any education. And and during a time, she saw that change in quite remarkable ways, where there were villagers that were asking for schools because of the work, you know, that was going on amongst the women and the children, and even in the sense of the Ziana, the place of like where that was pertaining to women, they were starting to kind of be able to come out more, and it was just some of the conversations that she had as well with some of the people. I mean, Karachi is a seaport, and so they used to kind of, if their husbands went to work on the sea or to do any trips, they would make offerings to gods, to the sea, basically. And so Blanche would talk to them about Jesus calming the storm to show that there was one that was mightier than the sea. And she had a habit of being able to tell stories to the ladies that really affected them, that really applied to them. And one of their favourite stories was the story of the prodigal son, because they just saw that there would always be a love of the parents for the son, no matter how bad they were. And they could sort of resonate with those stories. And Blanche kind of learned to be able to do that.
Adrian, it must be personally very satisfying for you to uncover this story and retell it to this generation.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it is, isn't it? She was just an amazing woman. She kind of reminds us, actually, of a lady that has since gone to glory, who worked tirelessly in the UK, you know, for us as a Sunday school teacher. For many, many years, and she just loved Jesus and she loved the children. And as I sort of explored Blanche's life, it was very much kind of resonated with that there was this lady that was able to sort of do amazing things in the lives of so many women and so many children. Mm. And, you know, she just cared for them so much.
Well, be encouraged. This, I think you've done all of us a wonderful favor by bringing her back to us from the shadows of history. And I was so encouraged to hear about her life and to see what God can do through just one person.
I mean, in a sense, there's there's hundreds of missionaries, there's thousands of missionaries all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And in Christian literature, we kind of get just a small kind of pinprick of information about all the missionary stories that there are in life, aren't there?
Well,
and we get to hear great stories, but there are thousands of them like it.
Well, at least in one case, you brought it back to life for us, and we appreciate that very much.
Yeah.
Adrian Russell. Adrian Russell, the author of Marvelously Helped, The Trials and Triumphs of Blanche Brenton Carey. We'll put it in our program notes, Mike, and it will be there for our listeners to order from Amazon or wherever they like to order it from. But
yeah,
I take it you've read the book and encourage them to read it.
Yes, and I actually have one that was signed by the author.
Oh,
so
of
I'm
course
not,
you do. Of
I'm not bragging or anything. Yeah, and what he wrote was, may the Lord bless and encourage you as you journey with Blanche.
Oh,
so I thought that was a pretty cool way to sign the book. So thanks, Adrian.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. That's great.
You're welcome, bud.
What a fun conversation. Michael, thank you for introducing us to Adrian Russell here in the program today. One thing I didn't mention at the top is that we will be hearing your teaching from the Walk with Jesus series you did at The Cove in Asheville, North Carolina. Today, we're calling this program Traveling Mercies, and today we'll trace the journeys of Jesus during his public ministry. You will, not me, you will, coming up. So
yeah.
That's coming up.
Together. We will do it together,
I'll be
Wayne.
Listening. I'll be listening intently. So, hey, Bob wrote to us and said, I enjoyed listening to this week's archive podcast while painting my living room. The three conversations are so densely packed. I was about to play them a second time. Then, to my surprise, you played a bonus track Never Will I Leave You. My family is weathering a difficult storm mm-hmm. right now, and the song struck just the right chord inside me. I had to put down the paint roller mm. and let the tears flow. I think maybe tears oh. are my best prayers. In a moment of clarity, oh. I turned my eyes away from the wind and the waves and fixed them on Jesus. That's
oh, wow.
That nice. That's from Blair.
Oh, thank you, Bob. Yeah, and you know, that's something that the Spirit uses music, I think, to touch us in places that just words alone or music alone yeah. doesn't.
Indeed.
Yeah.
That came from Bob. And now we have a song request from Blair, who listens, I think, to each and every podcast we do. Thank you, Blair.
Yes.
A very close friend of the program. Her request is, I yes. Will Bring You Home. So you want to talk about that song before we hear it?
Yeah. Though you're homeless, though you're alone, it the song switches between the idea of I will bring you home and I will be your home. Mm. The idea being that that right now God is our home, but at some point he promises to bring us home to be with him. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, we live in between those two promises, but that God is our home. Yeah. He's where our hearts find a home.
Well, this song will conclude the first half of our podcast, and then we'll hear Michael's teaching today. So here's the song, I Will Bring You Home.
Though you are homeless, though you're alone, I will be your home. Whatever's the matter, whatever's been done, I will be your home. I will be your home. I will be your home. In this fearful and fallen place, I will be your home. When time reaches fullness, when I move my hand, I will bring you home. Home to your own place in a beautiful land, I will bring you home. I will bring you home. I will bring you home. From this fearful and fallen place, I will bring you home. I will bring you home.
A fitting song from Michael that takes us to the halfway point in this podcast. We hope you'll stop by the Michael Card Music Facebook page and interact with other listeners about what you are learning, or reach us directly when you send your comments, song requests, or questions via email. Write to inthestudio@michaelcard.com. There's much more teaching and insights like what you've heard when you check out Michael's books and music. Explore all that is waiting for you at michaelcard.com. Well, there's more music and conversation coming your way after this message, In the Studio with Michael Card. Here's Michael with a word about the Christian Standard Bible.
I like new Bible translations because they help me see new details in the text. That's why I was so excited to be a part of the CSB translation team. The careful attention to original languages from godly scholars has made a version of the Bible that I use.
Visit csbible.com and explore the variety of options available to get this fresh translation into your hands. And when you order, receive your 40% discount on CSB purchases at Lifeway. Just type CARD40 with no spaces for your 40% discount. The Christian Standard Bible, a great translation, a great selection, and a great discount. So many study Bibles and editions designed to make God's Word accessible in your life.
I hope that you'll discover for yourself new insights as you read and study with this new Bible translation.
Find a copy online when you visit csbible.com. Thanks for continuing to listen today. Michael, I'm still thinking of that conversation about the missionary Blanche Carey from the past, and Adrian Russell shared that with us. He said that she loved Jesus, she loved the Word of God, she loved prayer, and she loved people. What a great way to summarize a life, huh?
Yeah, and I think somewhere in the book he mentions that she basically got through, I mean, an unimaginably difficult ministry by believing that God would give her each day the strength that she needed, a day at a time.
Wow. Wow.
And you read this book, the stuff she did was just remarkable, the suffering
great
that
lesson.
She went through. Yeah.
Great lesson for us. Okay, well, we got lots of listener mail here today. Here's another comment. Hello, Michael. I'm reaching out to you to tell you how much your music and ministry has touched me and encouraged me for the past 30-plus years.
Wow.
Your songs, God's Own Fool and Love Crucified a Rose, both caused my heart to leap with joy and gratitude to the Lord. Thank you for not just for sharing your music and your voice with the world, but for using your God-given intelligence to touch the minds of people as well as their hearts. I've learned a lot listening to your podcasts and lectures. Mm. Signed, Susan. That's a that's not your wife, Susan.
I don't think so. But
okay, all right.
But it always just strikes me that someone would take the time to write a letter of encouragement like that. I'm so appreciative, Susan, that you would take the time to do that. And believe me, it makes a huge difference.
I know you are grateful.
Yeah.
Later, we're going to hear you conclude with the song Emmanuel, and in a moment, we're going to hear Joy in the Journey, and in between, we're going to hear your teaching from the Walk with Jesus series at the Cove, and talk about the journeys of Jesus during his public ministry. So let's begin with a classic, Joy in the Journey.
And all those who seek it shall find it, a pardon for all who believe, hope for the hopeless and sight for the blind. With him who belong to eternity, stranded in time and weary of struggling with sin, forget not the hope that's before you and never stop counting the cost. Remember when you were lost, cause there is a joy in the journey, there's a light we can love on the way, and there is a wonder and wildness to life and freedom for those who obey. And freedom for those who obey.
Okay, so let me give you my rough data on the course and the trajectory of his ministry. And I say, for me, the ministry begins with the baptism and the temptation. So I'm referring to that as the beginning. And I'm not going to give you all the references. Yeah, you're welcome. And then he begins a solo teaching ministry in Galilee. This is like Mark 1, Matthew 4, and Luke 4, early on. And that there, I think there are implications to that. He doesn't need the disciples to do what he's doing. I mean, he can teach and do his thing. You know, obviously he's going to train the disciples and send them out and you know, get to a broader audience, as it were. But he doesn't need them. They are privileged to be a part of what he's doing. That's what I'm hinting at. And the indications in the Gospels are that this first solo preaching tour is very successful. So if I almost want to graph it. So he begins and, you know, it starts doing this early on. Very, very successful. Then he calls his first disciples, does his first miracle in Cana. In John 2, he makes his first trip to Jerusalem. If we didn't have John, we would just think that Jesus only went to Jerusalem one time, because the synoptics only refer to one trip to Jerusalem. And that's a third of the synoptics, is the last week of Jesus in Jerusalem. In the Gospel of John, half of John is the last week in Jerusalem, which is pretty incredible. If you were writing a biography, if the Gospels were biography, you would never do it that way, right? But they're not biographies, they're testimonies, okay? If it was a biography, it would give us a description of what he looked like, and which we're all frustrated about. So there's his first trip to Jerusalem, when the first, at the same time, the first temple expulsion happens. And so in terms of the trajectory of the ministry, that's the first time he has conflict with the leaders of the temple early on. And let me tell you what I believe. And I think, I won't be dogmatic about this, but I think it's a pretty cool idea. I do know, I can demonstrate that traditionally the marketplace for the temple was held on the Mount of Olives, not in the temple complex. And I think a good explanation for his anger at seeing it there is this may be the first year they moved it in there. So the only place in the temple there where the Gentiles can pray, they've set up a marketplace, and there's animals and birds and money exchange and that sort of thing. And I think that explains why he's so upset. Okay, so there's the So he begins early solo successful ministry, and then begins the disciples, the first trip to Jerusalem. And then there's, I don't know if you would say tearing up the temple made it a dip or what, but it definitely affects the trajectory of the ministry. As his popularity grows, he's driving out demons, he's teaching in synagogues, and he's healing. So he initially has a synagogue ministry until the crowds get too big. And then it becomes an open-air ministry. Okay, it's kind of hard to fit 10,000 people in a synagogue. So his popularity grows. One indication of that is, at this point in the ministry, we have the first occurrence of the Messianic secret. Things are getting really popular and getting crowded. And so for the first time he heals someone, he says, don't tell anybody. Because it's crowd control. He's trying to keep a lid on. And right after, that's Mark 1:43 and Luke 5:14. I've got references for all of these, but I'm just not going to throw numbers at you. But the interesting thing is, right after that first reference to the Messianic secret is the first mention of a large crowd. So the crowd's getting big. So if we're graphing, he begins his ministry, is successful, then there's some early success, and then it does this, I think. All of a sudden, we have 5,000, 10,000 people. And at that point, he calls more disciples. That's when Matthew is called. And also at that point, in the synoptics, we have the first plot. We have word of the first plot to kill him. So early in the first year of the ministry, I mean, this is Mark 3. So the first plot begins there. So after the early success, then we have the first word of a plot. And then we have words of the crowds growing even larger. And that's when he's saying, have a boat ready so they don't push me into the water. Okay? And at that point, that's Mark 3:9. At that point, in Mark 3:12, he repeats the Messianic secret again. Something happens, and he says, please don't tell anybody I did that. Which I still find is a fascinating part of him. At this point, we have the second trip to Jerusalem, only in John. It's John 5. And at this point, he appoints the 12. We read that passage, you know, calls them apostles, gives him authority. And at this point, we're given Mark 3:20. The crowds are so large that they can't eat. They don't even have time to eat. So there's this, in my graph, it seems like the crowds are doing this. Now they can't eat. There's just too many people coming and going. So he teaches the crowds in the wilderness. That's Mark 4. Mark 5, we read the crowds pressing against him. But occasionally, this is Mark 6, he'll still teach in the synagogue. So he doesn't completely abandon the synagogue ministry. So apparently sometimes he can still slip in and speak to the 40 or 50 people that could gather in one of those early synagogues. Oh, and at this point, he sends the 12 out on their first mission. Mark 6, Matthew 10, Luke 9. So when we saw that process, he's been with them, he's been discipling them, they've gone through various conflicts with him, he's taught them about the parables privately, and now he sends them out on their first mission. And right after that, the feeding of the 5,000 happens. So by now, we've got 15, 20,000 people, because 5,000 men, you know. And this is, so you know, we're going up and up and up and up, but this is where Jesus speaks of eating his flesh. And in big red letters, I have, his popularity starts to erode at that point. I see that as a turning point in the ministry, because it's just a little reference, and many of his disciples said this is a hard saying, and who can accept it? And a few verses later, I think it says, and many of his disciples stopped following him. They just can't. You know, like it's hard enough following him, you know, on a good day. But then when he starts talking like this, so I would say in the trajectory of the ministry, there's this pretty gradual, you know, peak. And then all of a sudden, I would call it a subtle erosion. I don't think it does that, but I think it starts to erode. And let's see if this bears this out. At this point, Mark 7 and Matthew 15, we have an investigative committee from Jerusalem coming. Judea is coming to check on Galilee, and they have a lot of power. That's 7:1. And I've never seen this before, but Mark 7:1. And Mark 7:21, that's when he goes north to Tyre. And that I think that may be connected to this, and these people investigating him. But, you know, the text doesn't say that, but I'm just wondering if that's why he would go. Tyre is a long way up to the coast of the Mediterranean. And the other new idea for me is Jesus standing on the coast of an ocean. I've never thought of that before, but Tyre's on the coast. So he goes up to Tyre, and then after that, the next step after this turning point is he does this sort of circuitous route around the north part of the Sea of Galilee over to the Decapolis. And you know what, you don't have to get all this in your head right now, but just get the idea that there is a structure, I think, to his ministry, and the popularity waxes and wanes, and the Gospels give us some indication of this. So I think, I mean, I love him. I want to know this stuff. So anyway, there it is. So he goes to the Decapolis, and then this is when his third trip happens to Jerusalem, and this is for Tabernacles. This isn't for Passover, this is for Tabernacles. And that's John 7, when he has the little engagement with his brothers, and he goes in secret. So that helps us sort of get a feel for this trajectory as well, right? He's going in secret because there's been this erosion of his popularity and the plots. There's more than one plot to kill him. We'll look at those plots tomorrow. And so he goes to Jerusalem in secret, but he gets there and he can't keep secret, because when they're in the temple court and the pouring of the water ceremony happens, he shouts out in the middle of this crowd, and it may be the largest crowd he ever spoke to. If a man's thirsty, let him come to me and drink. Not a good move for someone who's moving around in secret with multiple plots against his life, but I don't think he can't contain himself. It's after this, that's John 7:10. After this, we have the feeding of the 5,000. And the point of no return happens. They go up to Caesarea Philippi, which is another thing that really bothers me that he did that. See right to the left of Syria, that's Caesarea Philippi. It's right at the foot of Mount Hermon, that big bump to the north, that's Mount Hermon. I showed you that picture with snow, that's it, it's that mountain. Okay, so He goes to Caesarea Philippi, to this very pagan city filled with pagan temples. And it's in that context that he asks the disciples, who do people say that I am? And the Caesarea Philippi confession of Peter happens. You're the Christ. And that for me represents a turning point, because this is the first time he mentions to the 12 that he's going to suffer. So here's the trajectory, and then subtle erosion, and then starts talking about the fact that he's going to suffer. And it's at this point that the final, Luke 9, that the final journey to Jerusalem begins. So this is a turning point. The confession is made, he's the Messiah. And Luke says, Jesus resolutely set his face for Jerusalem. And chapters 9 to 19 in Luke are just him making that final trip. And I'm going to share some other insights on that, on his preaching during the final trip too. I hope you'll find interesting. So that's the long final journey to Jerusalem. There's mentions of large crowds traveling with him, but they're all going to Passover. It's not a large crowd that's just with Jesus. Everyone's going to Jerusalem for Passover. So this is his last trip to Jerusalem as for the Passover. He stops by Capernaum, and this is Matthew 17, and there's no mention of a crowd. In fact, there's no mention of a crowd until they get to Jericho in Matthew. So I think that's interesting. Now, I'm reasoning from silence, but you see what I'm doing? I mean, I'm not dogmatically saying this is what's happened. I'm trying to do some detective work and get a feel for how the ministry went. So they stop by Jerusalem, and that's the story of the coin in the fish's mouth, and there's no mention of a crowd there. And after that, raising of Lazarus, and the final stop is Jericho. He sees Zacchaeus on the way in and Bartimaeus on the way out, or maybe it's the other way around. Anyway, Zacchaeus and Bartimaeus are the two people that he encounters in that final trip through Jericho, and then he enters Jerusalem for the so-called triumphal entry. Then we have the second temple expulsion, and in Mark and Matthew both speak then of a final plot beginning. That's when the temple priests and the Pharisees come together, and there's nothing we can do. We're gonna have to kill him. And it's at this point that we have a series, and I was going to look at these. Maybe I still will. We have a series of trick and trap questions. That's when those questions start. They're trying to trick him into implicating himself, or they want to trap him somehow in his words by something that he said, and they can't do it. Should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? He can't say yes, and he can't say no. Whatever he says is going to get him in trouble. That's why they're trick questions. That's why they're traps. And he outsmarts them every time. It's at that point that he's anointed at Bethany. Then the Last Supper happens. And then the foot washing after the Last Supper, which only John can bring himself to tell us. Then we have Gethsemane, the arrest, the crucifixion, resurrection, return to Galilee, and the ascension.
A sign shall be given. A virgin will conceive. A human baby bearing undiminished deity. The glory of the nations, a light for all to see, and hope for all who will embrace his warm reality. Sing together, ready? Has dawned for all. those who stumble in the darkness. Behold, your light has come. Racing. Emmanuel, our God is with us. And if God is with us, who could stand? Your answer, or will you hear the call of him who did not spare his son but gave him for us all? On earth there is no power, there is no depth or height that could ever separate us from the love of God in Christ. One more time, sing it to the Lord.
Pray this time together has helped you make a deep connection with the Lord, and we hope you'll let us know how God used this session in your life. Please feel free to post a comment on the Michael Card Music Facebook page, write via email in the studio at michaelcard.com. Learn about Michael's books and music at michaelcard.com. You can write a review on Apple Podcasts or share the link with what you've discovered on your favorite social media platform. We're excited about the partnership with our sponsors at the Christian Standard Bible. Visit csbible.com. The Bible is the foundation of all we do in this podcast, and we're happy to point you to the many ways you can read and study with this fresh translation in your hands. Explore all that's available for you and use the 40% discount on CSB purchases at Lifeway. When you order, use the promotion code CARD40. Typed with all caps and no spaces to receive your 40% discount on CSB purchases through Lifeway. Choose a copy that fits your needs online at csbible.com. And join us again next week for another podcast edition. Now for Ron Davis, Susan Sermon, Lance Mansfield, and our producer Joe Carlson, I'm Wayne Shepherd. Thanks for sitting in on this session in the studio with Michael Card.